now to the Black Sea, as I said. It's an inland sea bordered by Turkey, Bulgaria, Romania, Ukraine, Russia and Georgia. Many European rivers emptied into it, and it has some of the world's most important coastal wetlands. But the Black Sea and its shoreline and intertidal areas are in big trouble, some would say on the brink of an environmental disaster, such as you just heard Richard Kingsford talking about in the Aral Sea. Joining me via Skype from his home in Sofia to discuss this is Dmytro Kenerov, a freelance journalist and writer who's been documenting this issue. Welcome to Late Night Live, Dmytro.
Thank you, Norman. Thank you.
And no doubt you were just hearing the conversation with Richard Kingsford a moment ago, talking about the Australian situation. Now, you're just tell us about this project you've undertaken in terms of drawing an environmental map of the Black Sea and its coastal area.
Yeah, well, the thing about the Black Sea is that, in fact, the strangest thing about the Black Sea is that it doesn't exist. And I'm going to explain what I mean is that unlike, let's say, the Mediterranean region or even the Caspian region, the Black Sea is very extremely fragmented. As you mentioned earlier, the sea is divided between, you know, Russia and Ukraine and Turkey and Romania and Bulgaria as part of the European Union right now, then Georgia on the eastern end. So there isn't really a Black Sea region. And unlike the Mediterranean, for example. And so there are organizations, of course, that try to sort of bring all these countries together and to work on policy and environmental protection. But it's extremely difficult just because Russia, of course, Ukraine, they have different agendas. Turkey has another agenda. The EU has another agenda. So trying to create a sort of a cooperation, trying to work on the Black Sea as a region, as an integrated body of water, is extremely difficult.
So
my project was basically I'm doing a project for the Pulitzer Center on crisis reporting, and the idea is to go around the Black Sea and to sort of look at environmental issues and try to integrate those kind of gaps of knowledge that we have and to integrate them into a greater whole, so we can understand the processes and the interdependence of various coastal lines to the Black Sea area.
So paint us a picture of what you've seen.
Well, I'm actually still at the early stages of the project. I just recently came back from Ukraine and Crimea, and of course, this region right now has a very different geopolitical focus. What we're looking at, of course, is the war in eastern Ukraine, the annexation of Crimea, the sort of the geopolitical wrangling between the EU and Russia. So not very many people are looking at the environmental situation. But, you know, unlike human wars, the environmental war seems to be never ending. It's the sort of the long-term war that we're all fighting. And so what I was looking at in particular was the coastal area of the Black Sea in Ukraine, where there are a lot of what are called limans. And limans are bays or estuaries, sometimes lakes. They do have sometimes access to the sea. Sometimes they're closed off by sandbars. But Ukraine is the Ukrainian coast of the Black Sea is extremely famous for those limans. And I'll give you one example which I think is very indicative of what's happening in Ukraine and with its history in the Soviet Union, of course, is that there is this place called it's a lake called Sasik. It's a little bit north of the Danube Delta, and the place has extremely interesting history. It was actually an open bay. It had access to the sea until the 70s, when the Soviet Union decided to build this enormous irrigation project from the Danube, connecting the Danube to the Dnieper River and through the Dnester. It's an enormous distance. But what they decided to do is to sort of wall off, to cut off all of these bays and estuaries that were on the Black Sea, to remove the salty water, to exchange it with normal water, and to actually try to irrigate with this. But what happened, and the project fell apart at the very early stages, they connected this Sasik liman, this Sasik estuary, with an artificial canal to the Danube River, and then they cut it off from the sea and they started pumping out the salt water. But the salt never really disappeared because there was so much on the bottom of the lake itself. And when they started irrigating, they in fact destroyed up to 30,000, some people say up to 60,000 actually hectares of land with salty water. And not only that, the entire tourist industry around this bay was destroyed. There were enormous algae blooms, blue-green algae, which depleted the oxygen and created an environmental disaster. And then there was, of course, coastal erosion. I actually went to a place, a really strange and spooky place, is a cemetery from the 18th century, which is being eroded by this water, and there are actually coffins and bones sticking out of the land, because the coast is like falling into the sea, and so you have this cemetery on the top of a cliff. And now half of it is down into Sussex, and you have bones and coffins sticking out. It's an extremely strange and spooky place. But my point was that the community has been fighting for years now to try to reconnect this bay to the natural environment, to the Black Sea. And although there is no irrigation going on, nothing, the lake has no real commercial value at this point.
Nobody wants to
do it. The Ukrainian authorities are still fighting against it because they continue to receive subsidies for an irrigation system that does not actually work. And so you can see in this Sussex sort of the history of Soviet, big Soviet projects that led to all these disasters, and the current sort of corruption within Ukraine that could not fix them.
And then there's this massive river, the Dniester, which begins in the Carpathian Mountains of the Ukraine and goes through Moldova and then back to the Ukraine, out to the Black Sea. And it's critical. Right. It's critical in this ecosystem in the north of the Black Sea, isn't it?
Yes, yes. They're actually, the interesting thing about the Black Sea is that it is all these major European rivers are emptying into it. Actually, the catchment area of the Black Sea is six times its size. So a big part of European drainage rivers come into the Black Sea. And it's not only the Dniester, it's the Dnieper, of course, it's the Danube River. And the big problems are, of course, what the previous speaker was talking about damming these rivers, which happened. These were the big Stalinist projects, of course, on the Dniester and Dnieper, but they continued later through the Soviet Union. The Danube River was also dammed by the Iron Gates in the 80s, which stopped the migration of fish, and for example, the population of sturgeon plummeted. It is not only the Dniester, it is the Dnieper, as I said, it is the Danube River, rivers which continue to... whose water regime has been interrupted, and such major rivers that continue to pour all these phosphates and nitrogen into from artificial fertilizers into the Black Sea, which leads to additional what's called eutrophication, the depletion of oxygen in the sea itself.
But there is some good news. I mean, they have created a national park in the Lower Dniester, haven't they?
Yes, yes, there's some good news. Actually, in the past 4 or 5 years before the conflict in Ukraine began, there was a sort of a spate of creation of national parks and quite a few coastal national parks were created. And in this we see, the increase of nesting birds, of course, the return of some fish species, particularly in the Dniester. So there is some good news, and some bird populations have increased. What we've seen, though, is that these national parks, these islands, they of course are not cut off from the global environment, And what we see is climate change is affecting these areas as well. Certain bird species, particularly in the migratory patterns, a lot of bird species are, for example, staying to winter in places where they weren't seen before. Their patterns of migration change. So these are things that are connected to the global environment. And in spite of the fact we have all these national parks, they're just little islands within a much bigger picture.
Now, what are the politics of this? Because you would imagine, even though we're talking about not the most active and vibrant of democracies around the Black Sea. If farmers are suffering, if the tourism industry is suffering, if the sea is dying, as you portray in some situations, perhaps, why aren't political regimes responding to the marketplace, if you like, and doing something about the upstream problems? Because you could fix up, have some nice coastal parks, but if it's still rubbish that's coming downstream or not enough water, then you're not necessarily solving the fundamental problems.
Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons, of course, for this kind of lack of action, I would say, is the weak political systems of the countries around the Black Sea. Usually, the coastal areas are partitioned in almost like feudal fashion. In Bulgaria, for example, most of the coast has been has suffered all this enormous construction in the past couple of years, much of it without any kind of water treatment plants, without, thinking in the long term. So the problem generally is sort of the weak political systems in these countries. And if there is some improvement in the situation, it oftentimes has to do with the change of the economic situation. For example, in the 90s, all these big industries around the Black Sea collapsed, the sort of the post-Soviet space. So when these industries collapsed, ironically, that was, much better for the environment, of course, although worse for the people themselves. Nope. And so that's when we saw a real change in the Black Sea. But these are not effects of policies, they're effects of sort of the general economic situation.
I'm talking to Dimitar Kenarov, a freelance journalist and writer who's documenting the environmental changes around, in this case, the Black Sea. Tell us, we've only got a couple of minutes left, but I promised the listeners that we would talk about the Sea of Azov, which, well, being a radio national audience, they've all heard of, but I hadn't really taken much stock of it. Tell us about the Sea of Azov, because it's a very hard to get to bit of sea, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the Sea of Azov is actually in certain ways, it's considered a branch of the Black Sea. It's the most northern part. It is the most remote section of the world oceans. To get there, you have to go, through from the Atlantic to the Mediterranean, from the Mediterranean to the Sea of Marmara, from the Sea of Marmara to the Black Sea, and from the Black Sea to the Azov. And the Azov, because it is also the shallowest sea in the world, its average depth is about 8 meters. And you have major rivers also flowing into it. So the salinity of the sea is about, it's very low. It's about 10 ppps, which is, very, very low salinity. But it used to be a huge, because of all this fresh water coming in, because of this shallowness, it used to be one of the most productive fishing areas in the world up until, the middle of the 20th century. But then the Soviet industry came in, fishing industry, and they basically trawled the whole place. They destroyed many of the fish populations. And so, and because there were also these industries around this very tiny, very, very shallow sea, which were pouring a lot of pollutants in there, the sea is today, unfortunately, pretty much dead. And of course, the Ukraine sort of Russia conflict, which Ukraine and Russia divide the sea between themselves, does not help things either.
Exactly. And that's a whole other conversation. We will follow your writing with interest and we'll have you back on Late Night Live. Dimitar Kenarov, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dimitar Kenarov, freelance journalist and writer. Now, tomorrow night on Late Night Live, we'll talk about why so much of our freight movement around Australia continues to happen on our roads. And the search for the remains of the Spanish poet and playwright García Lorca, murdered by the Franco regime, and his body has never been found, although some people suspect they know where it is. That and more tomorrow night on Late Night Live with me, Norman Swan, and we wish Philip all the best. See you soon.